Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, whatever time you are tuning in. Welcome to Homesteading and Gardening in the Suburbs. I'm Emma from Misfit Gardening, and today we're talking about how to keep your garden growing in tip-top condition. So let's dig in. One of the things that many organic gardeners seem to forget is, you know, the amount of effort that you put into your garden, the better your vegetables are going to taste. So there is an element of watering, feeding, weeding and protecting plants and providing support that we have to do in our garden. And the reward for that care and attention is, you know, really delicious homegrown produce. Now, watering I'm going to talk about first, because veggies and fruits and stuff need water, okay? There's no ways around that. Whether you get a lot of rainfall or not, as the case may be, where I live anyway, you have to provide water to your vegetable garden. Now, you can grow things that are more drought tolerant, so they can cope with that stress from no water a little bit better. But ultimately, you need to be watering your garden. And you want to be watering your garden deeply, so you know that's where you're watering until you can kind of see a puddle, and then stopping the watering, let that seep down, and then watering again until you see a puddle forming on that ground. And the reason why we're stopping as we're watering is because you want to allow that water to seep down into that soil, and you don't just want it to evaporate up at the top. You want it to have a chance to work through the soil and to where those roots are needed. So at least once a week, you might need to be watering a lot more frequently. So where I live, I'm having to water at least every other day. And some plants I'm having to water by hand every day. So it's just understanding your garden and your soil. And of course, having a soil that's rich in lots of organic matter. And by organic matter, we mean well-rotted compost, well-rotted manure, those kind of things that are worked in. It helps to conserve water in the soil. So this is really important. If you've got a sandy soil like I do, you can help enrich that soil by digging in organic matter. You can grow green manures and then turn them under, or you can use a continuous mulching method. So continuous mulching is where you're covering that soil all the time, basically. So things like straw is really good. Other people use things like farmyard manure, compost, even cut grass. So if you don't treat your lawn with any pesticides or herbicides, and you don't have a lot of puppies pooping all over it, for example, then you can you know, mow the lawn and collect those grass clippings and then spread them onto your soil. Obviously, if you've got a lawn that's treated, or you've got pets that are using it as a bathroom, don't put that near your vegetable garden, because we don't want to bring in some of those problems into your veggies. But when you're watering, definitely give those plants a thorough soaking and allow that water to penetrate deeply, okay? A light watering is just going to encourage surface roots that are going to be easily damaged by prolonged droughts. And, you know, if you're in those kind of conditions where it's hot and dry, then that's going to start your plant getting stressed, and it's going to start producing flowers and ultimately seed. Now, for some plants that might be good, but for a lot of others, like leafy greens, that's not a good thing that we want. I mean, nobody wants a cabbage to start flowering early. We want to be able to actually harvest a cabbage, right? So mulching has got a lot of benefits to it, and, you know, not just with protecting from soil loss, but mulching is also going to help protect those shallow roots that are formed, and that's going to help the plant from not stressing out so much. But also mulches provide a source of food. So, you know, if you've got heavy feeding plants like pumpkins and squashes and zucchini, stuff like that, you know, an extra feeding is super helpful, okay? And that's one of the things that a lot of organic gardeners forget, is to keep feeding their garden, even though we're working in a lot of stuff to the soil, you know, especially if you're a new garden and you've got a new gardener and you've got a new garden and you're trying to help things get established, then definitely keep feeding your plants, you know, look at them often, you know. Are the leaves turning yellow? Do they look a little bit sad and wilty? Or are they green and vibrant and lush? If they're green and vibrant and lush, then you might not need to feed them. But if they're looking like, you know, they need a little bit of help, then a little, you know, tonic for them is a good idea. And you can get a, you know, commercial, off-the-shelf, unrelisted organic fertilizers. And, you know, I've used those too, and they're great, some of them. I love the down-to-earth ones. I use them a lot in my garden because I have sandy soil. I do need to keep on top of the nutrient levels because things get washed away very quickly. And I'll link up to those in my gardening kit in the show notes if you're interested to see which ones I use. But you know, you can also make your own as well, and comfrey tea is a really popular one. So if you're growing comfrey plants, when you chop it all back, you can just basically put it all into a bucket of water and let that steep for a couple of weeks. It stinks. It really stinks. There's no two ways about it. But it's really good for your plants, and you can dilute about a cup into a 3 gallon watering can and use that to water your garden and plants with. Another way that people make comfrey fertilizer is to chop the comfrey, put all the leaves into a bucket with some holes in, and then put a weight on top to start crushing them, and then put another container underneath the bucket, or prop that bucket up onto some breeze blocks or cinder blocks, and then put a container underneath. And as that concentrated liquid drips down into the container, they can collect that, and then that's what they then dilute down to use as a feed. Either way, you know, works. It's just down to your personal preference. Some other like homemade fertilizers people can make are ones with strawberry leaves, ones with grass clippings. You can even do one where you pull all the weeds and just dump them into some non-chlorinated water and just let them break down. It can take a couple of weeks, it can take a couple of months, but eventually those weeds will all break down and release those nutrients that they pulled up from the soil. I like to call that one gardener's revenge, and that one's always worked very well, although my husband has a really unelegant name for that particular garden fertilizer. I'm probably not going to repeat it on here because I tried to be family friendly. Worm tea is also a good one to use, and you can do that by putting some worm castings in some non-chlorinated water, and then let that sort of stew for a couple of days. Some people add some sugar to it, or sulfur containing molasses, and that helps the bacteria get started, and then they can you know, whip it up or stir it up very vigorously to enter in some oxygen and help that bacteria get established, and then they'll use that to water the garden, because those bacteria, microorganisms that are in these natural fertilizers are going to help your garden, because they're going to help those plants take up those nutrients as they get established. So you can also use these mycorrhizal fungi and add those periodically. And that's one of the things that people who grow these giant vegetables do. They're using a lot of these compost teas, or, you know, like plant teas that they're producing, and they're using these mycorrhizal fungi to help their garden and their plant get established. Now, of course, the question is, how often do you apply these liquid feeds? Well, every week or every 2 weeks is usually typical, especially if these are ones that you're making yourself rather than using commercial preparations. You know, every week or every other week is just fine. And many plants are given their main feed annually. This is especially true if you are, you know, using a lot of perennials in the garden, you know, when you're adding in compost and stuff. But another way that you can add your nutrients or feeding to the garden is by side dressing. Now, I recently posted a video about this up in the Grow Your Own Food Academy on the private Facebook page, where I was doing some quick tips for tomato growing, and I was explaining what side dressing was, because one of the students in the Grow Your Own Food Academy asked me what it was. And really, it's just a fancy term to apply compost or fertilizer to a plant. And it's called side dressing because you're adding it from the side of the plant usually. So you're just kind of sprinkling a handful around the base of the plant, or if you're putting compost or mulch down, then you're putting it all around the base of the plant. And that's what side dressing is. So if you've got an issue where you're starting to really look at your garden and get in there and weed and see what's going on, if you're starting to see a lot of these surface roots appearing, then it is a really good idea to side dress with some more compost and some more mulch, and kind of make a mound around the base of your plant there, because that's going to help protect those roots. More often than not, what's happening if you're starting to see those roots is you've got shallow watering that's happening. It's not getting in there deep enough for those plants to really go down and search for that water. It also could be because the topsoil is being eroded away by your watering. So it might be that your hose that you're using is a little bit too aggressive. If you've got like one of those attachments that turn into a jet of water, then that's going to be too much. You're kind of thinking showerhead. A showerhead is usually the best way to be watering your plants if you're going to be using a hose. And of course, you know, overhead sprinklers too can actually wash away some of that topsoil too. So get in there with some really good quality compost. You can get the stuff bagged from the store. That's totally okay. There's no shame in that. Or you can get it from your city dump if they offer that service as well. I've just had to go buy some directly from a big box store, because that's all that was open during you know, the pandemic and everything that we're dealing with right now. So that's okay too. Now, if you've got a lot of fruit trees or bushes and those kind of things, then, you know, usually if you're going to be feeding those plants, you feed them in spring, and it's usually applied in the form of a slow release organic fertilizer, or it is a very, very good spreading of well-rotted manure or well-rotted compost around the base. Now, not up close to the trunk. You want to be kind of putting your fertilizers and stuff around the drip line of those plants, because that's where the roots are. So the drip line is where the branches and the leaves extend to, and then directly below that is usually where you find those feeder roots. All right, next up is weeding. And, you know, my garden sometimes gets weeded a lot and sometimes does not get weeded a lot. And you will find that if you don't weed your garden very often, you end up with a much bigger job on your hands because you're trying to battle these more established plants. Now, a weed is simply a plant that is in, you know, a place where you don't want it. And weeds are going to be taking up some of those nutrients that you are trying to put down for your garden to grow. And, you know, getting in there and weeding by hand is very labor intensive. It's good exercise though, but it does take time. But if you're weeding by hand, it is one of the better ways to get those weeds out, because you're right there and you can see the roots and you're able to, you know, pull those things up. Now, I've got a lot of raised beds, and weeding by hand is really the only way that I can do that. In the test garden bed though, it's much easier for me to hoe around everything, and I love using the hoe to do that. It's one of my favorite garden tools for a main, like, in garden type of garden. Obviously you can't use those in a tall raised bed scenario, but a hoe makes very quick and light work of doing, you know, these weeding activities, because it just slices off the top of the plant from the roots, thereby killing it. So it's really, really good to do that. But we want to be getting rid of those weeds, because they do compete with your plants for that light, the space, the water. And one of the other things that we don't necessarily talk about why we want to weed is a lot of weeds can harbor pests and diseases that can then spread into our garden. So by making sure that we're keeping weeds well away from our garden, we're removing some of those host plants that, you know, those pests really like to hang out on. And same for diseases. Like in my garden, for example, I will always see powdery mildew on the bindweed. And when I see powdery mildew on the bindweed, I know that that stuff is then going to be spreading to my squashes and everything else that I've got growing in the garden. Peas, beans, squashes, they're the most susceptible here in my garden, but I try to be very diligent at removing the bindweed, because that is the first thing to get it in the garden. So try and keep areas weed free, and, you know, even areas that have got like lots of mulch on them, or you've got very close plantings to try and shade things out, they do need regular checks, because you will see that you've got weeds kind of getting established under the canopy there, and just you know, pull them out as you see them. And it could be as simple as just challenging yourself to do, you know, one small garden bed a day if you've got raised beds, or, you know, maybe you garden and, you know, weed a row. I've actually found that it's really therapeutic to do so, and because the temperatures are getting a little bit hot where I am, I'm kind of limited to the time that I'm getting out there and gardening. So I might be getting out there before 7 in the morning on a weekend to do some of these things, or I will be going out and doing gardening like after 3 o'clock in the afternoon when the sun's kind of passing over and my garden is starting to get into the shade a little bit, because I'm very fair in terms of my complexion, so I burn very quickly, even with factor 50 and factor 60 sun hat and everything else on. So I try to fit in some of my gardening activities around not just my work schedule, but also the schedule of, you know, how hot it is going to be out there. And like I said, little and often is, you know, really better to be doing it that way rather than weeding irregularly, just because you're going to be finding it a lot easier to keep on top of everything. And, you know, one of the best things that you can do is, you know, do some weeding and then apply some mulch, and that's going to help cover the soil and reduce the amount of weeds that you've got coming back. Next up, I want to talk a little bit about plant protection. So I talked a little bit about protecting from pests and diseases a minute ago, but there's, you know, so many different pests and diseases in the garden, and they vary so much depending on where you live. And over time, you're going to know which specific problems your garden is prone to, okay? Keep a garden journal. I can't stress that enough. A garden journal is so helpful, because you're going to be keeping a note of, you know, the things that are going to be affecting your crop each season. What control measures you used, how often did you feed, what variety grew well, what didn't, all these things. And if this is something that you would find really interesting, like what sort of things you should be recording in your garden journal, then please let me know over in the Facebook group, and I am quite happy to bust out my garden journal and tell you what I write in there. But, you know, in time you're going to have a record of, you know, how often you get these kind of pest things, what time of year they typically arise, and how you manage them. And it's really important that if you know these things ahead of time, then you can start to prepare for them. But also, you know, even if you're a new gardener, like getting out there into your garden on a regular basis and really checking what's going on in the garden, that's going to help you. And make those notes, you know, oh, I'm starting to see yellowing leaves on this squash, or I noticed these grey splotches on this plant, or, you know, this leaf on my Swiss chard had a really weird, like, you know, winding river pattern on it. You know, these kind of things are flags of various pests and diseases. And, you know, you could start to, you know, research those, find out what's going on, and then you can start to take measures to protect your plants. So maybe you need to put some organic slug pellets down, maybe you need to set some beer traps, maybe you need to use some diatomaceous earth. Like, there's lots of things that we can do to reduce the pests in our garden. There's also lots of things we can do to encourage beneficial bugs into the garden to help, you know, monitor and the pest burden, which is the level of bugs that you get. So you could look at maybe growing things like nasturtiums or French marigolds, poached eggplants. Different herbs are really good at attracting beneficial insects. So things like dill and fennel are really well loved by lots of different insects, and those will help to bring in things that are going to help alleviate some of the pest problems. If you've got a lot of aphids that you've noticed, or whitefly underneath the leaves of your cabbage plants or brassicas, for example, you know, maybe you want to be using a soapy water spray to knock those off, or perhaps you just want to introduce more ladybugs, ladybirds, and lacewings into the garden. So, you know, really using some good record keeping is going to be really helpful to you. And, you know, if you're having like a lot of problems that you're seeing with a certain pest over the years, then maybe you could start to look at protecting your plant in a different way. So maybe building a cage to prevent those pests from getting in. And I say that because that's a very common way to protect carrots in England. People grow them in like a mesh cage to prevent the carrot fly from getting in there and laying the eggs and producing the maggots that are boring through. And people grow their carrots next to onions because the onion scent masks the smell of the carrots, and the carrot scent masks you know, or helps to deter the onion fly on the other side. So there are different measures that you can do to benefit many different plants. So that's called companion planting. And there's a lot of great resources that are out there for it. One of my favorite is Tomatoes Love Carrots, and that's a great book that's got a lot of different companion planting schemes in there. So I will hook that up in my gardening kit in the show notes. And finally, one of the things that I want to talk about today is providing support. And that's, you know, just really making sure that plants have what they need in terms of growing. So if you're growing pole beans, you know, the key might be in the name there, or they're also known as climbing beans in the UK. So they need to have support to grow up and over, okay? And this support needs to begin at an early age, because trying to wind in a plant that's got a lot of growth on it can be very difficult. Same with tomatoes. You know, a lot of people like to use tomato cages or train their tomatoes on a line. That's what we've done this year in the greenhouse. But the earlier that you do it, the easier time you're going to have, because there's nothing worse than trying to wind established plants around a string and hope that you don't break off branches that are laden with fruit, okay? There's a couple of good reasons why we want to grow these things upright, and that's because it's going to free up space in your garden bed, because the plant's going to be going up rather than out and along the bed. It also means that you can plant more in that space, which is great, because you can put things closer together. Not too close, but you can definitely put more things in there. And even plants like zucchini can be trained up a trellis. And that's going to help them get more light as well. It can also help pollinators find flowers for things. And it also looks pretty as well. But I really like the idea that you can plant more in the space, because you're able to really open up that garden bed. I also grow over trellises things like squashes, pumpkins, and I will tell you right now that one of the best ways to support pumpkins and melons and stuff like that that is growing, ladies, old bras are amazing for holding these plants, okay? They are really good, because you can obviously put the plant into you know, the normal use of the bra, but you could also just use it to kind of set on one side, and then the strap you can just hook onto the trellis, because I have cattle panel trellising, so it's easy for me to kind of hook things over. But because the bands are really, really strong on them, if you've got, you know, big melons and big squashes growing through the trellis, no pun intended there, but they're really good to support those things, and they work really well. It does look a little bit odd in the garden, I will give you that. The first time my husband saw it, he was kind of bemused for the longest time. But then, you know, my girlfriends who all garden, they get it. And people, I've seen people doing it all over the place now. So, yeah, definitely think outside of the box for plant support. But it's a really good idea if you're growing these bigger squashes or melons and things over a trellis. You have to provide support for them, because the weight of the fruit growing is, it's going to snap that vine, and we don't want that. We want to keep that plant growing. We want to keep those fruits getting the nutrients that they need until they're ready for harvest. And finally, I'm going to give you a bonus one here, and that's about harvesting. And you know, it's really tempting to pick out all the good specimens and leave the rest. But, you know, you need to pick even the bad ones and get those out of the way of the garden. Like if you've got things that, you know, are showing signs of disease, you really want to be removing those and getting them out of the garden. But also, you know, picking the right things when it comes to harvest time. You know, you want to be picking your plants at the peak of their, you know, growth, when they're ready, because then they're going to be full of those, you know, nutrients and vitamins and stuff like that that your body needs, and they're going to taste so much better. The other thing, of course, is letting some plants go to seed and saving the seed for you to grow the following year. And this is especially true if you're growing heirloom varieties or landrace varieties. I definitely encourage, you know, people to at least leave a plant in the row that they're growing, or a plant in the box that they're growing. Just let it go to seed and save those seeds and try and grow again. And the reason why I say this is because there's a variety of tomato that I've been growing for like the last 4 years, and each year I've saved seed from it and grown it again. And I've now got tomatoes that are like the size of my hand. They are massive. They're not a beefsteak variety, it's a canning variety. And I've just been very diligent in making sure that I save seed each year from the garden. And each year I grow again with these seeds. I'm seeing better and better results from the garden. And, you know, I love kind of experimenting with plant breeding anyway, and I did a whole episode about land-raised gardening, which you should really, really check out if you're interested in that. But if you're growing heirlooms and not hybrid varieties, because you won't be able to, I mean, you can save the seed from the hybrid variety, but when you grow it out again, it's not going to be similar to what you grew the year before. You know, definitely save that seed and start to really own where your food is coming from, not just from the garden, but from the seed supply as well. Anyway, I hope you guys are all doing well and that you enjoyed listening to this episode. Stay safe out there, and I hope that your garden grows beautifully. Until next time, I'll see you next week.